That's Hugh Masekela, South Africa, with Tim Lela. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. It is Thursday, December the 26th, and a new CNN poll out today finds that two-thirds of Americans believe the current Congress is the worst in their lifetime, only 28% disagreeing. And 73% of respondents, rich and poor, young and old, Democrats and Republicans, agreed that the 113th Congress is a, quote, do-nothing, unquote, Congress. 52% believe that the policies of the Democratic leaders in Congress would move the country in the wrong direction. 54% say the same thing about congressional Republicans, and 54% say the same thing about President Barack Obama's policies. Fewer than 60 bills have been signed into law this year, the first year of the 113th Congress, or the first year of President Obama's second term. And political observers are predicting that it would be even slower next year when most lawmakers are somehow focused on the midterm elections. So at that pace, they think Congress is on track to be the least productive Congress in at least 40 years. Well, we pick up from where we left off just before the holiday. I hope you had a very enjoyable one, those of you who celebrate. And so we're back to this business of, I should say, compiling our own State of the Union address. We are doing so by identifying the major problems and challenges of the year that is soon going to disappear, ushering in 2014. What do you think were the most significant issues, events, and people emerging in 2013? Why would you select those issues, events, and people? And what is your forecast, if any, that these people, these events, these issues may have, if any, in 2014? That's the gist of our discussion. We had a very good discussion, the first part. I told you that until the end of the year, until the 31st, we'll be in this neck of the woods. We'll be assessing the year that was, and we'll be taking a look at what we might have to expect in the year 2014. 888-874-4888 is the number to call to get that started. A couple of announcements, in fact, one major one. If you are accustomed to going to the podcasts, to download podcasts, they may or may not be up on the same day. This is owing to some vacation, the well-earned vacation that the folks in the archives department need, and they'll be back on Monday. So if you don't see anything listed for maybe a day or two, be assured that it will be up on Monday so that you will have it available to download and to listen at your leisure. I also want to thank so many of you. I mean, incredible feedback, lots and lots of feedback on my email site, leadstories@gmail.com, and also on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Very, very thoughtful comments and opinions, and I really do like that. You know, you give a sense of where things are with the program and the meaning of the program to you, whether it, you find it useful or whether you have points that we're not covered. These things are very useful, so it's always good to drop me a line, and I try my best to get back to folks as in a timely manner as possible. So I do cherish hearing from you. I do enjoy it, and I also take I also regard it as feedback about the value of the program. Does it have value? Is its content relevant to your informational needs? Well, as we look at this task today, it's not about pointing fingers of blame or anything like that. It's not like that, even though we'll be doing that if we can't avoid it. But I'm looking for analysis. I'm looking for you to go beyond just the literal sense of what it is we get in the way of news, whether on television or in a newspaper or on the internet or wherever it is you now get your information from. How do you interpret what it is that we are to understand as our current reality? And, of course, like everything else we talk about, when you evaluate an event or you evaluate information, you also want to place that information or the event or story in its proper perspective. Lift it out of perspective, it just becomes, you know, a one-shot deal. But it becomes meaningful when you put it in its proper context and give it a fuller meaning, fuller interpretation. So I'm looking for that kind of reaction today. I don't want to tell you how to, express yourselves. You will be doing that quite capably. But I just wanted to have, you know, a special kind of meaning, especially since we are at the end of the year. So we have adequate context in which we can place our ideas, and therefore it will have particular kinds of meaning. All right, so let's go. 888-874-4888. Sarah, you're on. Hello.
Greetings to you, Utrice.
Thank you, and you too.
Well, I guess, what is it? Kuchi Chagali is what we're supposed to say for today if we do the Kwanzaa thing.
Well, okay.
I guess so. But Utrice, I must let me digress a little bit in the so-called holiday spirit. You know, you would not guess. I thought of you yesterday. I made some pepper pot, and I said, you know what? I'm sure you
drink. With or without Kasri?
You know I had to do it the old school way.
Oh, well, then you're in good shape.
Yes, I did that, and I also did some homemade bread to go with it. So I was thinking of you, Utrice, so I'll have a bowl and think of you.
You should describe what Kasri is. People may not know.
Yes, it's made out of cassava root. So for those of you who still
and pepper pot.
Yes, pepper pot. It's basically oxtail meat cooked in a very dark gravy sauce. So it's very tasty. We normally do it at this time of the year with some ginger beer, and of course the pound cake and all of that good stuff.
Ooh.
But we're digressing from the topic at hand. You were speaking in the news and how we decipher the news. You know, Utrice, I happened to look at my former hometown of Atlanta, Georgia, and I was reading where they're starting to have buyer's remorse as to what's going on with their representatives, because I'm seeing John Lewis, C.T. Vivian, as well as Joseph Lowery. These are all three people who were given the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama. Now they're coming out screaming bloody hell because of these judges that he's nominated all Republican to be on the circuit court, as well as on the district court from Georgia. Now they're all crying and talking about voting right laws. You know, as usual, that's the only thing that gets these people moving is when it affects the voting and election. That's when they're going to come out and start squealing like pigs. So that's the only thing that got their goat, is because of these Republican these conservative Republicans that he's putting on the court, and they're saying that he needs to pull these nominations. Now, these idiots. Let me get in a good spirit.
Yes, indeed.
No name calling. These are the type of things that you see that when they were being wined and dined at the White House, and now that this is a lame duck, because Utrice, nothing is going to happen until the end of his term.
But these, you know, I'm going to come in the defense of a couple of these people. Lowry has never really shied away from speaking his mind at all. In fact, he was he was consistently critical of the Obama administration. He was very vocal about that. The one that surprised me in the group was John Lewis, that you said. John Lewis had been very much
Utrecht, he has spoken, but sometimes he has spoken in such a low tone that you really have to put your ears to the wall to hear what it is that he is saying, because they are trying all their darnest in order to make this man into a success, and everything is telling them that it's not going to be a success. You're sacrificing yourself on the altar in order to make sure this man is successful, because nothing is going to be done until the end of next year, because it's midterm elections is coming up. They're not going to do anything that's going to alienate them from their voting constituents in doing anything that is going to be inflammatory. So this is all going to be lip services that's going to be done, and the typical pundits are going to be put out here, the Sharpton, the Jacksons, and all of them going to put out here to rally the bases, and they're not going to do anything. And then the last 2 years, when these people get sworn into Congress in 2015, is going to be cruising until the next election in 2016. So right now we can see Utrecht, it's just the deal is done. The pot is sealed. You know, we might as well just put this time capsule in the wall and just seal it up, because nothing is going to be, is going to come of this. This is all charade theater that they're putting on in order to distract us, to say that, okay, we're going to be doing something, but they are not going to be doing anything, because what happened in Detroit, what has happened all around with this regentrification, these emergency managers, the schools, it is atrocious, Utrecht. I never thought in my lifetime that I would live and see some of this mess that's what's going on with us that we have found ourselves in.
Well, I tell you, more and more people are beginning, especially in the African-American community, are becoming more and more vocal about it. Reverend Sharpton had a town meeting, as they called it, in Chicago,
yeah, Chicago.
On December the 19th, and he was only too happy to pack up and get out of there, because the crowd, which was expected, I think people thought they were going to be very, very, you know, into the agenda that was set, and they turned on them something. I've been looking at the coverage of it.
I saw the video, and I heard some of my friends out in Chicago. They turned on them like they should, because
they did.
They sat back and they allowed, because Sharpton is just basically the hatchet man, the guard. Just think of Sharpton basically as the junkyard dog, the one that you put out in the yard to keep the people away from the fence. So you can't get to the White House gate, because Sharpton is circling around that White House gate to keep you, backing you off. That's all that he does. Because you have all of these, you know, what is so disheartening, Utrecht, is that here it is, you have all of these big black ministers. You have the Jesse Jackson, Minister Farrakhan, Jeremiah Wright. Why does Sharpton need to come from New York and come up to Chicago to do a meeting? You have all of these big people up there in Chicago who've been there for years, know the layout, but he has to come, some Yankee carpetbagger has to come up there and tell these folks what they need to do.
Well, as I said, people are waking up, because they did not, from what I had seen, and I saw quite a few reports about it and the videos of it, they were just too happy to shut down that mic and get the heck out of Dodge, because they were being pilloried and roasted by these irate people in the community who, I think, people have misread the anger that is now pervasive in the African-American community. So it's worth keeping in mind.
It is bad, Utrecht, I'll say this and get off the line, but they've been begging and they've been saying, okay, the president put his library in Chicago on the south side. I can tell them right now, Utrecht, and you can go ahead and get your lottery ticket in place. That library is moving to Honolulu, Hawaii. That's where he's taking it. He's not going to put none in, because he's already got his house on the market for sale in Hyde Park. He is packing his bags and is going to move to Chicago, because you already got the Lincoln Library in Springfield. They're not going to put another presidential library in Chicago. It's going to Hawaii. So they can beg and plead all they want. They should have done that as a part of their condition before the 2012 election. Stick a fork in it. It's done.
Okie dokie. So how do you really feel, Sarah, about these things? you're holding back.
Yes, ma'am. Let me go drink me some ginger beer and I'll calm down.
Thank you so much. Thank you
You're
for calling
welcome.
Today. Thanks. 888-874-4888. You know, I got to tell you, that community town hall meeting that was called, I'm getting ready to present it. There are some issues I have with the recording quality that might make it difficult for people to hear. So I'm trying to get the best quality possible. But it was significant in that the crowd just went absolutely nuts on these folks. They were not taking any of this PR stuff coming in the community and you're holding a town meeting and, you know, the warm glow of the television lights and it's recorded that you've been there and you've discussed something really important to the community. We discussed this issue of gun violence so many times on this program and what a farce it is to think that it's a one-size-fits-all solution. And anybody coming into the community talking about, well, we ought to deal with gun violence. Well, you know, yes, people have been saying this. I even quoted the federal report that said it was epidemic proportions. It had been this way for decades. But we all know what the solution is. If you're going to solve the problem of gun violence, it means you have to have a real, serious, comprehensive program that involves quality education, involves employment for adults as well as working age teenagers. It involves monitoring the actions of police. Many times the police are the ones selling the guns. In Miami a couple of weeks ago, they found cops selling guns right out of the trunks of their cars. Okay, and they've been doing it for a long time. The cops in many of our communities are part of the criminal element. I've told you the story about Larry Davis, who even in his mid-teens or pre-teens started being cultivated by police officers. And by the age of 14 or so, he was already a multi-million dollar business entrepreneur selling drugs and guns and running a prostitution ring for the cops, who even gave him a bazooka if that's what he wanted to protect his drug turf. Now, when you say these things, people think you're just coming up with these atrocious things out of nowhere. It's been documented, absolutely documented. And that was a case that was supposed to trigger a comprehensive investigation about what police officers, many police officers, are doing in poor communities. They have these ways of corralling these young men, and that was part of the stop, question, and frisk method in New York City. And they would ask them all kinds of questions, which they called pedigree information. And when the time came to make a collar, as they say, to make an arrest, which would be, you know, entered into the books that they're doing something, they just arbitrarily match a kid to a crime and say, okay, you did it. And then the poor kid's court-appointed attorney would obviously go the regular route of saying, hey, they've got a lot against you. You better take a plea. So a kid who should be defended, completely innocent, is forced to take a plea because he doesn't want to spend a threatened 3 or 5 years in jail. And this is one of the things I raised in with respect to the Central Park case. This new mayor coming in, William de Blasio in New York City, supposedly is going to okay or speed up the damages of the young men who were railroaded in the Central Park case. And that's not enough. That is not enough. This mayor needs to get at the root. It had to have involved some police misconduct, because how you get evidence, crazy tainted evidence that you tailor make to incriminate people. So there's got to be some investigation of that. There's prosecutorial misconduct, as sure as I'm sitting here talking to you. And there may even be judicial misconduct. So And this is routine. This is a problem. It is not a new phenomenon. This is routine. So, there you go. That's how criminal justice is dispensed in our community. So, it was, in a way, refreshing to see that people were coming to their senses about the state of affairs, the realities with which they're living. And they do not deserve it. They deserve better because they have made the investment, not once, but twice, in this president and his administrations. And there's very little to show for it. Very little to show, if anything. So the fact that this is swelling up in Detroit, people are just, you heard it right here on this program, people have had it with the leadership. Chicago, they have had it with the leadership. It's happening in Washington, D.C. It is happening in New York City. You heard Alton Maddox talk about that on this program in Philadelphia. It's beginning now to resonate that, hey, you know what? Enough with all that sentimentality and emotion. Let's get down to brass tacks. What have we yielded from our investment in this particular president? But what did we get? That's the question. You think you have the answer? 888-874-4888 is the number to call. 888-874-4888. All right. We'll wait for another call before we go on. I was thinking of taking a break, but we'll do that and wait for your call coming in any minute now. This is what's important, to connect the dots. It has taken a very long time for people to connect the dots. This is year 5 of Barack Obama's 8 years in office. Year 5, you could say, is a write-off. I can't imagine that any group of people understanding 5/8 of a person's terms in office are done. And we still have all the fundamental things indicating that he's still at the bottom rungs of the ladder. And he has made it even more impossible for you to move up. Just heaping inconvenience and all kinds of limitations upon you. You can't move. You're suffocating. And he thinks it's okay. I'm going to be doing that's next week though. I'm going to be doing 2 pieces on this particular president and encouraging people to understand that this is the time you absolutely, positively must punish, absolutely punish the Democratic Party. The Republican Party is no better. But because, quote, liberals, progressives, black people, Latinos, tend toward the Democratic Party, it is time to absolutely just get rid of it. It has accounted for untold suffering. And these are deliberate acts. This is not something that just happened and, you know, they're going to make it right. These things are deliberately done. And they're done because we talked about the zero-sum thinking, that anything that smacks of benefit to a person absolutely must be in short supply. Prosperity is such a thing. You can't have too many people prospering. It's bad. So you will have to have winners and losers. One side will get all the prosperity and the other side gets nothing. You know, that's the thinking as well in this administration. They haven't gotten out of that way of thinking because that at bottom is the philosophical underpinning for policymaking in the United States. things that are good for you, things that would help you prosper, things that would help you improve, things that would give you a leg up. Those things are tightly controlled. They're considered too strategic, too important to have everybody have access. Healthcare. They deal with healthcare. Like, you know, you can't have healthcare, but if you are to have it, we make you pay through the nose for it, which is to say, the people who can afford it, it's nothing to them. This is not an expense at all. They spend more money than that on cat food and dog food. All right? So the expense of healthcare is no problem. It's not even part of the, it wouldn't even make a dent in their day-to-day operating. That's why the president himself recently just deigned to sign up for his own care, which he says he doesn't need it, but symbolically, which is even more offensive, that he could afford to buy something that he will not use. Okay? He didn't take the top of the line one. He took, you know, the bronze package. So it's going to cost him $5,000-$6,000 a year. What's the big deal? That's no big deal. But when you take a look at the way people are living, the people who are hurting, and the kind of imposition this is on a person or a family just literally trying to get from Monday to Tuesday with a finite amount of money that simply cannot provide everything. And then out of nowhere comes the so-called law that is hoodwinked through Congress and then hoodwinked through the U.S. Supreme Court, and now it becomes a law, and you are now responsible to add to your living expenses, you know, to add at least 50 to 60% of your current expenses, to add that on to what it is you can't afford right now. You see what I mean? This is coming from a so-called liberal president. But next week, before this year ends, I intend to just go through this business about President Obama, what he really represents, and what his term is to be looked as, you know, what has it meant for people. And I will show you, I will make the argument that it has been all about business. The people around him are entrepreneurs. They are entrepreneurial civil servants. They see money everywhere that they need to make. And this president was their way of getting in to make the money and to make the connections from Hillary Clinton all down. That's what they've been in office for, to make money. They are entrepreneurial legislators and public servants. And business is number one. Their business, not yours, theirs. We'll take this break and come back to your thoughts at 888-874-4888. This is your time, time to express yourself. We'll come back right after this. BRN.FM, you're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. The number is 888-874-4888. As this year comes down to the last day, we are, what, three more broadcasting days until the end of the year, and we're looking for your input in terms of how you have interpreted the events of the year and how you see things, or whether you see things going in 2014 the way you think they ought to be going. Your opinions, this is what matters on this program. 888-874-4888. It's very important, I think, to give room to your thoughts so we get a sense of where people are going, where people are, what people are experiencing, where their minds are. And I must say that for the most part, people I've talked to are very disappointed, very depressed, very, very depressed, because there has been a sense of betrayal, there's no other word for it, by this president and his administration. There's great anger, disappointment, and just plain, people are livid. They feel that they, to quote Malcolm X, they feel they've been took, you know, they've been had, they've been bamboozled. And it is not a good feeling, because the president does have the opportunity to turn things around. But of course, it would require something that I don't think this president has, which is confidence and faith in his constituencies, that they would back him to the hilt. And he just veered off on his own tangent very early in this game, and in doing so, signaled to the people who would have backed him and people who would have had his back. He signaled to them that they were, you know, they were discardable. They're not permanent in his heart at all. They're just numbers, and they're the numbers who just perform perfunctory tasks. The perfunctory task being showing up and vote. That's all. Show up, vote, get lost. And that's the way he too has regarded his own constituencies. It does not make people feel good. Even if, let's say, the president were doing things, taking a chance, being rather out of the box in the way he is approaching domestic and foreign policy, let's say he was being very, you know, off the books about it, very unpredictable about it. But people sensed that the intention is to get something positive done. That is, it's a genuine effort that has their benefit at front and center of it. I think they would have related to him very differently. But in the end, he does not respect his own people. He doesn't. And people need to get over this business of, you know, feeling constrained to air their views publicly. In fact, it is very important that that be done, because the machine needs to understand that there is a consequence to betraying the people. It hasn't really gotten that lesson. It has really not gotten that lesson, not with this president, or any other for that matter. Look at the way the community still loves and adores Bill Clinton, who just, you know, put their lights out. But they just like the guy. And if he were to run for president tomorrow, Bill Clinton would have a very good shot at it. Hello from Baltimore. Green, you're on the air.
Hi, Lise. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And you?
Good. You sound good. Are you better now?
You know, I'm trying to get better, but I'm getting there.
Well, I wish you a very speedy recovery.
Thank you.
You know, you trace... When I the first time I heard your show, I was so impressed that I Googled you, and so I had to find out who this person was. And, you know, it's quite obvious that you are no lightweight, and you've been in the struggle for a long time, and you've been remarkable. And so I always, you know, I am reticent to disagree with you about anything.
Oh, no, don't be. I like disagreements. I really do.
No, but I am. But I have to disagree with you about the president.
Okay.
You know, I think that this president is probably the best president, or at least one of the best presidents, that the United States has ever had. And in the sense that he represents what America represents. And it's never been about the right or doing right. It's been about business from day one. And what he's doing for U.S. businesses, I think, is remarkable. When he ran the first time, you know, I told friends of mine not to expect too much, actually not to expect anything, because he's running for president of the United States. He's not running for president of black people. And America, and I was so impressed with your caller Tuesday, the young lady who seems to be, you know, as they say, connecting the dots. And she mentioned that America has never been about African people.
Well, that's DACA.
Ma'am?
That's DACA. I remember her name.
Yes, ma'am. And those of us who expected anything to come from this man, you know, were being totally naive. And I wish that his presidency could make African people realize that America is not about them, but I'm afraid it won't. And a lot of the opposition to Barack Obama that keeps people from realizing how good an American president he is simply the fact that he's black. And that's ironic too, because no matter how much we want to fit in, you know, we're still black. And according to the rules of white supremacy, you know, we represent everything that is wrong and evil. But I think that if white Americans in particular, you know, could be honest with themselves, they'll realize that this man represents the best of America. Now, if it sounds like I'm praising America or praising the president, understand that I refuse to even call myself an American, although my family has been here in this particular part of the earth, you know, for centuries. I don't even call myself an African-American. I'm an African. And if you want to be technical about where I live or where I was born, then you can call me an American-African, but I'm an African. So I think, I download your programs, and I like to listen to them, you know, over again, because there's so much to learn from not just you, but your callers. And I was listening to the program about Mr. Harrison the other day.
Hubert Harrison?
Yeah, Hubert Henry Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Jeffries said that Harrison saw or believed that the first thing that we need to confront is white supremacy. And even Dr. Jeffries...
his name is Jeff Perry.
I'm sorry, Jeffrey Perry.
Right.
Dr. Perry.
Yes, yes.
Right. And even Dr. Perry agreed that he thought that was the correct strategy. But he didn't go into really explaining what white supremacy is and how it works, because unless you understand exactly what it is, and how it works, then you can't understand why it's so important that we deal with that. But it's not so much we deal with it in other people. Black folk need to purge themselves of our own white supremacy, because everyone who's been brought up in this world, which is controlled by the European, you know, is brought up as a white supremacist. This is why, even though Obama is black, we see in him what we see in black leaders, not just in this country, but all around the world. We're so busy, you know, believing that white is supreme and the white way is the right way, that we can't do anything for each other. We can't see African people as being worthy of the sacrifice, like someone like Alton Maddox or yourself or other people who have been willing to sacrifice themselves for the benefit of our people. We don't even see the worth in each other. So
your point is very well taken. I think, and this is one of the things that I think people have been trying to discuss in terms of, you know, across the board, racism affects everybody. Racism makes racists more racist. It makes the victims of racism as racist as the racists. Because the people in power have the tools to enforce their thinking, enforce their enculturation. You know, growing up in Trinidad, for example, my older brother was in the cadets. It's like the Boy Scouts, all right? Now, what are the cadets? Okay. You're dressed from head to toe in wool, all right? Because this is the way the British dressed. It works fine for their climate. But here you are in the middle of the tropics, sweating bullets. And, you know, this is the kind of thing. You are to, even though it doesn't make sense, but you mimic the people who control your life in their behavior. You like what they like. You hate what they hate. You dress the way they dress. You eat what they eat, that kind of thing. So everybody is shaped by it, and it is not unique to the United States. It's the way it is all over the world. The person doing the conquering has the military might and the benefit of systems that are created to perpetuate control. So you become a byproduct of their thinking, of their thought process. You become the reality of their thought process. So it is very hard for people to get to themselves, and this was what one of the points that was raised in our last discussion. It is hard to come to terms with yourself if you are educated away from yourself. You are an alien in your own body. So this is huge.
I believe that you are, you know, right on the money about that. Could I offer a solution?
Sure.
Okay. Well, as you identify, the problem is that we are educated away from ourselves. So we need to reverse that process and begin to educate ourselves. And nobody's going to do it for us. We're not going to get it from school, you know, no matter how far we go in school. We're not going to get educated back to ourselves, because that wouldn't be in the interest of the white supremacists, which includes us. We think it wouldn't be in our interest. But we need to, we need to educate ourselves. We need to educate ourselves back to ourselves. And to do that, we need to read. We need to listen. We need to learn everything we can about who we are. And I'm talking about what Carter G. Woodson was really talking about when he said we should take at least 1 week to study the history of the Negro. He wasn't talking about African Americans as it's presented now. He was talking about African people around the world throughout time. Because when we learn what we were, and what we still are but don't know we are, then it'll change our whole outlook on everything. Even the fact that, like you said, when I, the first time I called, we are worldwide people. And this is why I'm against those, you know, us using those words, Latino, Hispanic, Spanish, because it's a means to separate black people who speak Spanish from black folk who speak English and other languages. We're worldwide people. And like Raul Castro said in his address at Mandela's memorial, the blood of Africa runs through the veins of the children of Cuba. And that's true. The Cubans are basically a black people, as are the Puerto Ricans, the Dominicans. And I was listening to the musician from South Africa, Jonathan Butler, and he said when he goes home, he's colored. When he goes to comes to the United States, he's black. Because, see, all these terms are artificial, and they're created for political reasons by the white supremacists to divide us. We're one people, and we might look differently, but we're one people. So I've taken up enough of your time.
I listened to your profound thoughts, and they're certainly worth hearing. The challenge is, you know, do people understand how important it is to have a sense of self? When you don't have a sense of self, and I'll get into that when I talk about President Obama, when you don't have a sense of self, you literally, you're a dangerous person. Because you are immune to all kinds of cultural constraints that would guide you and hold you in, that would give you focus and give you grounding. But if you don't have a sense of that, if you don't have a sense of yourself, I don't care what your ethnicity is, you can appreciate somebody with a strong sense of self. That's great. You're dealing with a whole person. But this president has made no secret that this is a thing that he struggles with. He does not have a sense of himself. And he continues to say it in a way that I would think somebody would be embarrassed to say that.
He's
saying it to basically draw attention to the fact that his father deserted the family. But then, you know, you take a look at Bill Clinton. His father deserted the family too. His father was a violent drunk. So, but he still had a sense of self.
But Clinton is white. He's a white supremacist. And white supremacy benefits, you know, white people in all ways, including psychologically. And Barack Obama is also a white supremacist, like most of us are, even though we don't want to admit it. We can't help but be. This is the society we've been brought up in.
I have a theory about Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton has some issues. He's not a blue blood. And this is a very, it is hammered home all the time. He is not an American blue blood. The people who have been in leadership positions in the United States, whites who have been in a position of leadership in the United States, uniformly are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants from old money, or in some cases, you do have the exceptions here and there. But Clinton is not a blue blood, and in his own sphere, that is not something that is overlooked.
Yeah, but still, you know, he's still a white supremacist, and so is Barack Obama, like most of us are. See, I don't want to just, you know, criticize Barack Obama for being a white supremacist. The overwhelming majority, if not all, black people are also white supremacists. And so white supremacy works to the benefit of white people, not saying they don't have issues, because they do. And that's why so many, you know, white people committing suicides and mass murders. But white supremacy definitely works to the detriment of black people, especially as far as our psyches are concerned. And this is why, you know, we've been in a struggle for 600 years, 500 years, and we really haven't, you know, significantly changed things because we won't deal with the root that causes us to be, that disables us from, you know, dealing with our situation effectively, and that's the idea of white supremacy. And I agree with you about dumping the Democratic Party, but I think that we should dump America. Does that mean leave America? Not necessarily. Does that mean, but what it does mean, we need to stop supporting America. You know, we tell our children to go into America's military so that the military can make a man out of them, or I guess now a woman out of them, when that's the job of the family and the community. We hold America up. We have no idea how important black people are. Even if you're getting welfare, you're supporting America because your money goes right back to business. You don't have anything to invest. You know, so we need to dump America. And unemployment, there's no reason black people should be unemployed, because we could build our own economy with the money that passes through our hands in this country. But we feel we're dependent, because of white supremacy, on the supreme people. And as the inferiors, we just can't do without them. And it's not true.
I appreciate your points. I disagree a bit, but we could pick that up in our next discussion. I see where you're going. I understand your points of view. I really do. And I think you make some profound observations in terms of everybody being affected by this malady that just will not go away. And it won't go away until people confront it. This is what it is.
I'm just going to leave you with, we need to read. We need to read, read, read. And thank you for the time, Ms. Etrice.
Thank you so much, being from Baltimore. Thank you for calling and contributing so meaningfully today. Well, that brings us to the end of our conversation. I'm going to be talking about the president in a slightly different way, and meant, of course, to encourage us to see things a bit differently. It's not that I take great pleasure in beating up this man, you know, I don't. But I'm not one of those folks saying, well, you know, we ought to give him a pass. No, he needs to work. He needs to work for the investment that has been made. He needs to deliver. And we should be very unemotional about it. We have to collect one way or the other. And so we have to play the game differently. If the one person in the Democratic Party offends so many of us, you punish the entire party. That's what you do. That's what they understand. You make sure that it does not have a prayer. You create your alternatives, but you punish the party. The entire party, you punish it severely so that they understand you're not to be messed with. Because at some point, people have to honor the integrity of their own contribution. And it's been done over and over and over again. So we'll be talking about that in my lectures. Coming up next is Occupied Territory, America, with Mike Fader. Stay tuned for that. You can always reach me, leadstories@gmail.com, or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lee. Thanks. See you tomorrow.